School Disuse Association. Good afternoon, everybody. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today's the 4th of May. We will continue listening to Master Tenzin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapel. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello once again to the program, and if this is the first time you've joined us, welcome. We're going through a text titled Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun by the Tibetan master Namgyal Pel. This text is a commentary on the 7 points of mind training that started out as a secret teaching but became widespread when another Tibetan master, Geshe Chikawa, decided it was too important to hide away any longer. We're actually just starting the text and have got to the point where Namgyal Pel quotes the first instruction of the 7 points of mind training, which is, first, train in the preliminaries. Which seems pretty obvious. We're not going to begin at the end and work to the preliminary practices now, are we? However, what does the preliminaries actually mean? Namgyal Pel explains, this involves contemplating the significance and rarity of life as a free and fortunate human being, contemplating impermanence and death, which leads to the realization that our lives can end at any time, and thinking about the causes and results of actions and the vicious nature of cyclic existence. From these basic practices up to the training in the ultimate awakening mind, the practice can be divided into two, the actual meditation session and the period between sessions. The actual session is also divided into three, preparation, meditation, and behavior. Firstly, as the life story of Guru Dhammamati of Sumatra shows, we should decorate the place, arrange representations of the three jewels, the Buddha, that a fully awakened being, his doctrine and the spiritual community, offer a mandala representing the world system, and complete the 6 kinds of conduct, up to the request that the 3 great purposes of self, others, and both shall be fulfilled. Previously, with help from His Holiness the Dalai Lama's commentary, we described how to set up the representations of the 3 jewels, to take refuge in them, or, as His Holiness puts it, to take refuge in a safe direction, offer a mandala, and then recite the 7-limb prayer. This prayer is addressed to the Sangha. In the Mahayana tradition, that is any or all of your teachers, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. If you are familiar with the prayer, you will know the so-called 7 limbs. But for those not so familiar, there are prostrating, offering, confessing negativities, rejoicing, asking the teachers to remain and also asking them to teach, and finally, dedicating one's merit or positive potential. We start with visualizing the particular Sangha before us and then reciting the prayer, a short version of which goes, reverently I prostrate in body, speech, and mind in faith, and make clouds of every type of offering, both real and mentally transformed. I confess my negativities since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtuous conduct of ordinary and noble beings. Please remain until samsara ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all virtuous conduct, my own and others, to great enlightenment. Now you may wonder, what is the purpose of all this? Actually, this prayer has a twofold purpose, to purify negative karma and to accumulate positive potential. It is usually taught that this 7-limb prayer is a powerful way of gathering positive potential, and as we go through it, you may see why. But now, before we go any further, let's set our motivation as we normally do, steering our minds towards bodhicitta, the wish to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, if we can. That is the best, but if that is too difficult, at least think this program may become a cause for your own liberation. Thank you. Now, last week, when talking about the first two limbs of the seven-limb prayer, we followed Dr. Alex Berzin's explanation, in which, you may remember, he said prostrating was throwing ourselves in the direction of enlightenment so that we can best help others. By doing this, we show respect for those who have achieved enlightenment already, for our own future enlightenment, and respect for our own Buddha nature, the ground that allows us to eventually attain enlightenment. He said, we can imagine prostrating or actually do physical prostrations thinking of the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that we want to emulate and achieve. Now, I don't know how keen you are to do physical prostrations, but with an old and creaky body, I find them a little difficult. But perhaps I just have too much pride, because one of the aims of physical prostrations is to eliminate pride. Anyone who knows Tibetans will know physical prostrations are a favorite practice with many of them, and they can do them for days on end. If you ever go to Tibet and visit Lhasa, you will see many Tibetans prostrating endlessly in front of a particularly revered temple there called the Jokhang, which contains an ancient and very meaningful statue of the Buddha as a youth. As an example of how the Tibetans view prostrations, there was an article 8 years ago in the BBC about a Tibetan monk who decided to prostrate all the way from his home in Lhasa to the stupa in Bodh Gaya, India. Now, this is about 1,300 kilometers. Amarnath Tiwari interviewed him and his helpers and wrote this. Now remember, this was written in 2007. Sherab Geltson has already been on the road for 1 year and 8 months. He doesn't run or walk. Instead, the Buddhist monk from Tibet takes 3.5 steps forward, then prostrates flat on the road while chanting mantras. Then he gets up, folds his hands in prayer, and repeats the process. He averages 6 kilometers of a day. For protection, he wears a thick apron, fortified shoes, and gloves with a wooden pad on the palms. He recently crossed the border from Nepal into the Indian state of Bihar. His destination is the Buddhist pilgrimage center of Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha is said to have reached enlightenment under a peepal tree. It now houses the world-famous Mahabodhi Temple, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Tibetan Buddhists believe that prostrations bring merit in the quest for enlightenment. This type of prostrating pilgrimage is hard enough at the best of times. The potholed roads of impoverished Bihar make it worse. Geltson set off on his journey from Tibet in July 2005 with a friend. They reached the Nepalese capital, Kathmandu, on 29th of November. Neither can speak Hindi or English, and the friend returned to Tibet. Geltson is now accompanied by a Nepalese couple, Sonam Yeshi and Pema Tsomo, who take care of his daily needs. The husband and wife pull a handmade tin sheet cart mounted on bicycle wheels that carries their provisions, including drinking water. We've 2 folding tents, sleeping bags, a stove, some utensils, and food materials in our cart, says Sonam Yeshi, who also translates for the prostrating Tibetan. Sherab Geltson makes some attempt to communicate with the locals through body gestures and, more often, simply by smiling at the staring onlookers. What about food? We've with us a bag of rice, wheat, barley, and fruits. We eat twice every day, at 10 in the morning and 6 in the evening, Sonam Yeshi says. Geltson loves to drink barley soup and eat apples and banana. He also sips tea and water offered by people on the road. When the party gets short of supplies, the husband and wife inform their guru in Kathmandu, and he sends provisions on to them. We do not accept money or anything valuable from the people on the road, Sonam says. Bihar is the most lawless part of India. Aren't they scared? No, not at all, Pema Tsomo says. Once we entered Bihar, we got to know that people here are very courteous, nice, and of a helping nature. Moreover, we do not carry hard money with us. She smiles. The Bihari people offer us food, water, money, and even touch our feet, or just greet us with respect by folding hands. However, there are doubters. One local told the BBC that the monk might be a spy sent from China. So far, the monk has stayed well and fit, despite the demands of his long and torturous journey. It has really been very difficult, Sonam Yeshe says. At some places, there are no proper roads, and then there are big trucks and buses bearing down on us from both directions. Sherub Gelson agrees. It's scary. It's even tougher and harder than the hilly terrain of Tibet and Nepal. The unmarried monk has three brothers and an old mother in Lhasa, the Tibetan capital, from where he began his journey. His long pilgrimage is nearly over. Another 16 days and we will complete our journey, the Tibetan monk told us, sipping yet another tea before slipping into his blue folding tent for the night. No doubt, when he arrived in Bodh Gaya, he would also have spent many days prostrating in front of the stupa. If you've ever been to Bodh Gaya during the teachings of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you will know of the many Tibetans who hire wooden prostrating boards and then spend hours every day prostrating at the stupa. And it's not only the young ones. You are just as likely to see wizened old ladies and men throwing themselves on the ground as younger and fitter devotees. When I was last in Bodh Gaya so many years ago, I sponsored a monk from my monastery who wanted to complete 100,000 prostrations at the stupa, which he duly did. That kind of practice is known in Tibetan as a nundro, or preliminary practice for a long 3-year retreat. I don't know, but I doubt whether that monk ever progressed to such a retreat, for I understand that he went and lived in America. He may be still there, though I haven't heard from him for a long, long time. So that's the traditional way of doing prostrations. But if you want to prostrate, but for some reason can't fall full length to the ground, or even half length, touching the ground with hands, feet, knees, and head, you can also merely put your hands together in a prayer mudra. Do this with a mind of deep respect, and it is also said to be a physical prostration. After prostrations, we come to the second limb, offerings, which we went through quite comprehensively last week. Traditionally, we would offer the 8 things that a good host would offer an honored guest in India in the Buddha's time. That is water for washing, water for drinking, flowers, incense, light, perfume, delicious food, and music. In Tibet, where resources were sparse, they offered bowls of water representing these things. So, traditionally, 7 or 8 bowls would be put on the altar. Sometimes the 2 waters, one for washing and one for drinking, would be included in 1 bowl, and that's why you might find 7 instead of 8 bowls on the altar. However, as Dr. Berzin said, if you only have a single bowl, that is fine to use for an offering. And we shouldn't think that we can only offer the traditional substances. Anything that we find attractive and wholesome can be offered, even if it's only visualized. The next part or limb of the practice is usually known as confession, though Dr. Berzin doesn't particularly like that translation. He says it brings in unnecessary and perhaps misleading associations from non-Buddhist systems of thought. Rather, he says, we are openly admitting that we are not always able to help others. Sometimes we are lazy, distracted, selfish, and so on. In the context of karma, we admit that we sometimes act very destructively, but we regret that and really wish that we were not like that. It's not that we have to feel guilty. We really don't want to be like that, and that's quite different from guilt. Then we say we'll try our best not to repeat it. We'll try. We cannot promise never to be destructive again. That would be absurd. But we will try. How are we going to overcome this? It's by going in the safe direction of refuge and bodhicitta. We reaffirm that that is what we're going to do. That is our foundation. Then finally, we apply opponent forces to counteract our mistakes and shortcomings, which means we will apply whatever we learn here as an opponent. We're going to use it to go in this direction, not just to do it for no reason. That is the third limb, openly admitting our mistakes and shortcomings. In effect, Dr. Berzin is describing the 4 opponent powers, which I have mentioned a number of times before on this program. Essentially, these begin with coming to an understanding that an action we have done is harmful to oneself or others and regretting it. That regret is the first opponent power. Then we put ourselves in a safe direction, which also means correcting our relationship with the beings that we have wronged. We either wrong other sentient beings or the highly realized beings like the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The harm we do to our relationship with other sentient beings will probably come from one of the 10 non-virtuous actions: killing, stealing, sexual exploitation, lying, slander, harsh words, gossip, harmful thoughts, covetousness, and acting out of wrong views. The harm we do to our relationship with great beings will come from showing disrespect, breaking vows to them, and so on. Now, to correct our relationship with these great beings, we take refuge, or once again, put our life in a safe direction. Then, to correct our relationship with other sentient beings, we can rededicate our love and compassion to them, but particularly make the bodhicitta aspiration to attain enlightenment to benefit all other sentient beings. Having corrected our relationship and reaffirmed our safe life direction, we then perform the third opponent power, that is, some action that counters the harmful action. If we've taken the life of an animal, for instance, we can save the lives of other animals. There's a wonderful man in America who saves the lives of brine shrimp, tiny sea creatures bred to be fed to other people's aquarium pets and so on. You can send him some money and he'll buy the shrimp and release them for you. The great thing about this is that you can save millions of lives for a relatively small amount of money. Buying insects or larvae like fly larvae or worms for the same amount of money might only save hundreds of lives. Then the fourth opponent power is promising not to do the action again. As Dr. Berzin says, we probably cannot promise never to do it again, but we usually promise for a period of time we think we can avoid it. Then we try as much as possible to keep that promise. So those are the four opponent powers that come with this limb. Although the recitation of the line, "I confess my negativity since beginningless time," doesn't specifically make mention of them. Notice, though, that with this line, we recognize and admit that we've committed negative actions in all our myriad lives right up until this one. This is because we've had a strong but mistaken sense of I that is the root of all our afflictive emotions and karmic actions in all those lives. If at any time we were freed of this I, we would now be enlightened and not subject to sufferings. But as we do suffer, we are still under this I's influence. Therefore, we can say we have created negativities in all our previous lives. You may wonder if we can eliminate the karma from all those negative actions. After all, we don't even remember the vast majority of them. However, it is taught that regret and purification can be like burning down a forest by setting a single tree on fire. We don't have to know all our negativities to weaken and eventually destroy the negative karma. We just have to recognize we have them and then apply the opponent powers forcefully with a strong intention to destroy them all. So this is how we deal with openly admitting and dealing with our mistakes and shortcomings. Now Dr. Berzin describes the limb of rejoicing. "I feel it's quite important for us as Westerners to change the order here," he says. "Usually we first rejoice in the Buddhas and so on. I think that for us, since so many of us have a problem with low self-esteem, after pointing out our shortcomings, we need to first rejoice in our own good qualities. We have admitted that sometimes we act destructively and selfishly, but sometimes we act constructively as well. We need to reaffirm and rejoice in everything positive and constructive we've ever done. On a more basic level, we all have Buddha natures, which means that we all have the ability to be helpful, to be compassionate, to be understanding. And that is fantastic. It's wonderful. It's on this basis that we can grow and become Buddhas through all the positive and constructive things we do. It is important to feel positive about ourselves and our abilities after we have admitted our shortcomings." In his book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, Ajahn Brahm has a lovely story that bears a little bit on what Dr. Berzin says here. It hints not so much at rejoicing at what we've done, but at what we are and what we can become. It's called the two-finger smile, and this is how it goes. The hardest person to give any praise to is ourself. I was brought up to believe that someone who praises themselves becomes big-headed. Now, that's not so. They become big-hearted. Praising our good qualities to ourselves is positively encouraging them. When I was a student, my first meditation teacher gave me some practical advice. He began by asking me the first thing I did after getting up in the morning. "I go to the bathroom," I said. "Is there a mirror in the bathroom?" he inquired. "Of course." "Good," he said. "Now, every morning, even before you brush your teeth, I want you to look in that mirror and smile at yourself." "Sir," I began to protest, "I'm a student. Sometimes I go to bed very late and get up in the morning not feeling my best. Some mornings I would be frightened to look at myself in the mirror, let alone smile." He chuckled, looked me in the eye and said, "If you cannot manage a natural smile, then take your two index fingers, place one on each corner of your mouth and push up, like this." And he showed me. He looked ridiculous. I giggled. He ordered me to try it. So I did. The very next morning, I dragged myself out of bed and staggered to the bathroom. I looked at myself in the mirror. Ugh, not a pretty sight. A natural smile was not a goer. So I got out my two index fingers, placed one in each corner of my mouth, and pushed up. Then I saw this stupid young student making a silly face in the mirror, and I couldn't help grinning. Once there was a natural smile, I saw the student in the mirror smiling at me. So I smiled even more. The man in the mirror smiled even more. In a few seconds, we ended up laughing at each other. I continued this practice every morning for 2 years. Every morning, no matter how I felt when I got out of bed, I was soon laughing at myself in the mirror, usually with the help of my two fingers. People say I smile a lot these days. Perhaps the muscles around my mouth got kind of stuck in that position. He goes on, "We can try the two-finger trick any time of the day. It's especially useful when we feel sick, fed up, or downright depressed. Laughter has been proved to release endorphins into our bloodstream, which strengthens our immune system and makes us feel happy." That's Ajahn Brahm. But does this mean we don't need to only rejoice in our good deeds, but in our silliness as well, do you think? I'm just joking, but I think you see the point. If we can feel good about ourselves, even through tricks like the two-finger smile, it'll be much easier to feel good about others and the works they do. It's a bit strange that Dr. Berzin doesn't mention rejoicing in the virtues of others, but goes on to say that we next rejoice in the great beings and those working to become great beings. He says, "Then we rejoice in the Buddhas, those who have actually realized their Buddha natures, and in others who have been working in that direction. I'm happy for you. You did it. Bravo." But even more, we rejoice in the fact that they taught how to do it. This we rejoice in enormously. "I cannot thank you enough, Buddhas and great masters of India and Tibet, for having taught this, explained it, and written it down. That is unbelievably fantastic and kind. Thank you. I really appreciate it deeply." That is the sentiment that we want to have here. They could have easily gained realizations and gone off to a Buddha field to rest and not be bothered with us. Now, I'm not so sure about that, because if a Buddha has infinite compassion for all suffering beings, why would he or she go off to rest in a Buddha field and not be concerned with us? Surely that would not be possible. But anyway, rejoicing in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas has more to do with the effect on ourselves, body and mind, than anything else. Then returning to Dr. Berzin's omission of rejoicing in others' virtue, the line in the prayer says, "I rejoice in the virtuous conduct of ordinary and noble beings." And in his text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, for the limb of rejoicing, Shantideva starts off by rejoicing in the positive actions of beings not even interested in liberation. That is, those who do positive actions that will lead to good rebirths in the future. They may not even be thinking of future rebirths. He then goes on to rejoice in the virtue leading to the state of an arhat, and finally the virtuous actions of bodhisattvas and Buddhas. So although Dr. Berzin here talks about the virtues of oneself and the Buddhas, it is important, I think, to rejoice in the positive actions of all beings, whether they are on the Buddhist path or not. In the book, The Buddhist Fasting Practice, The Nyungne Method of the Thousand-Armed Chenrezig, Wangchen Rinpoche tells the story of how rejoicing works. He says, a devoted person, King Kusala, was offering meals to Lord Buddha and all his followers. Outside of his palace, an old beggar woman took great delight and joy in the king's virtuous deeds, delight in his good fortune from his past life, and delight in his continuous accumulation of merit in this life by making offerings to the Buddhas. Being omniscient, the Buddha knew of her pure rejoicing, and he asked his disciple, the king, when doing the dedication of merit, should I dedicate in your name or in the name of another person whose virtue is greater than yours? The king politely responded, please dedicate in the name of the other person whose virtue is greater than mine. So the Buddha dedicated the merit that day in the name of the poor beggar woman. It went on like that for 3 days, and the king was not very happy. His ministers discussed the issue, and one of them came up with a solution. He spoke to the people who gave the leftover food to the beggars and told them, when giving out the food, just beat up the old woman. And that day, the beggar woman became very angry, and she didn't think at all about rejoicing. Again, the Buddha knew, and on that day, the Buddha dedicated the merit in the king's name. You may ask how a simple rejoicing can result in virtue equal to that of a deed when another person is actually performing the deed and yours is just a thought. Here's how it works. Mental phenomena are primary amongst all phenomena. Therefore, virtuous deeds associated with thoughts are most powerful and deeds associated with the body and speech are less so. Thus, having a pure heart is the most important thing, and the ability to rejoice is a demonstration of pure heart. As I recall the story of the beggar woman, at that time, the Buddha was making prophecies about the future Buddhahood of his fellow bodhisattvas and devoted kings and patrons, and that king expected to hear his name too. It was a long time before the Buddha spoke his name, and this had something to do with his treatment of the old beggar woman. So that is the limb of rejoicing, and then we come to the limb of requesting to teach. Dr. Berzin says it is usually called turning the wheel of the Dharma, but that sounds a bit abstract. We're so thankful that the Buddhas have taught. Now we are saying, please teach me, I want to learn, I'm totally receptive. We can do that before a class, before meditating, or before studying a Dharma text at home. It's not that we are asking someone to grant something to us, but in making this request, we're really inspiring ourselves. We want to gain something, to learn something. Can you see how this is building up to a more receptive state of mind? Wangchen Rinpoche also says, in today's world, there are many examples of people looking for a true spiritual teaching and path, and although they may desperately want to find a pure teaching and pure path, many are unable to find them. Some find a wrong teaching and a wrong path, and others who may find Buddha Dharma might still not be able to find the right teacher and the right teaching. Because of that, they may become upset and turn away from the Dharma altogether, creating the same kind of karma again that was the cause for their being lost in the first place. Then one never knows for how many lifetimes they may get caught in a vicious cycle like this. If done properly, requesting the Dharma teaching will help one to overcome this unfortunate situation once and for all. He says, a true teacher and true teaching are absolute necessities. Without them, we have no way of learning anything. Every little bit of knowledge that anybody has comes from a teacher. Therefore, it is absolutely necessary to request that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas teach the three vehicles so that we can overcome pain and suffering and confusion and illusion and experience the wisdom mind of the Buddhas. And that is where we have to leave it for today. Thanks for joining the program, and I hope you'll tune in again next time. Please dedicate all positive potential from the program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Have a wonderful week. Thank you, and goodbye.